Hi, everybody. Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is the great Nashville engineer, Bob Bullock, and he's going to tell us some stories about the Nashville way of working, as well as what it's like to record with Steely Dan and Mutt Lange. So that should be a lot of fun. But first, let's talk about YouTube's Music Key. Well, it finally happened. YouTube has been threatening this for a while, and it's finally a reality. Their new subscription service is called Music Key, and it's now in beta. What is Music Key? Well, first of all, it allows you to watch all the videos that you want without any ads. No pre-roll ads, post-roll ads, or banner ads for that matter. And that's very cool. But there's more to it than that. You can also listen offline. So in other words, you don't have to be connected to the computer in order to listen to audio that's coming from YouTube. The other thing that happens is you can also listen to music in the background, which is important for mobile. And the reason why is if you're on your phone, for instance, and you're on an app, you still want to be able to listen to music. So this allows you to listen in the background, which is cool. But there's more to it than that. When you sign up for Music Key, you also get access to the entire catalog of Google Play. And what's Google Play? Well, that's the Google subscription service for all of their videos and all of their audio. And there's about 30 million songs. It's as good and as extensive as just about any other streaming service out there. So you get all of that as well as everything that's on YouTube. That's pretty substantial and it's pretty cool. And because there's so much, because you get the audio plus the video, or the video plus the audio, and this huge catalog of videos and songs and everything else. If you're a music lover, you might think to yourself, why should I invest 10 bucks a month for Spotify or Pandora or Apple Beats or whatever the case may be when I can get so much more from Music Key? So as a result, I think you're going to find that a lot of the streaming services are pretty much shaking in their boots right now, and they're going to have to come up with some new features really fast. That being said, you can't access Music Key right now. The only people that can access it are the ones that Google invites. Google, of course, owns YouTube. And this is invite only. It's a beta. You still have to pay, but you only pay $8 a month. That being said, after the beta period ends, you get that for lifetime. So in other words, you pay $8 a month forever, while everyone else still pays $10. So there's one sure way to actually get on the invite list, and that's to sign up for Google Play right now. So this is the best way to actually get Music Key right now if you're really hot and really into it. Sign up for Google Play, and you'll get an automatic invite. I think one of the cool things about this as well is the fact that the worst name for a streaming service is finally gone, finally put to rest, and that's Google Play Music All Access, which is what they called their streaming music service. That's finally gone. So now it's just Google Play, that's it. And I would bet that sooner or later, it's all going to be folded into Music Key, and that's all. So that's exciting. YouTube's Music Key is now a reality. The other thing I really want to talk about is the fact that Gibson Guitars and associated brands are moving into the Tower Records building at the edge of the Sunset Strip in Hollywood. Anyone who's ever been to Hollywood, Los Angeles, and has made the pilgrimage to Tower Records back in the days of CDs and LPs, you know what a great place that was. It was the place to be to buy records. Not only was it extensive in that it had a huge number of great catalog titles there, but it was the beginning of the Sunset Strip. It was this iconic building. And what almost happened was it was almost converted into a three-story office building. The current owners wanted to do that. They wanted to make it into an office building. And the preservationists of West LA, and this is, of course, part of West LA, they got together and they basically said, no, wait, this is an iconic building and it should stay as is. And Gibson signed a 15-year lease. So that's pretty cool. Now, it'll be used for a couple of different things. First of all, it'll be the showroom for Gibson Guitars, but Gibson is now so much more than just Gibson Guitars. Of course, it's Epiphone Guitars, which we all knew, but they also own Slingerland and Baldwin and Wurlitzer and Tobias. And they also own a lot of consumer brands as well. Gibson now owns Teac. Remember Teac? Makers of the first four-track reel-to-reel tape recorders. They also own the consumer audio brands Onkyo, Integra, and Esoteric, and they also bought Philips Entertainment. Why is that important? Well, Philips Entertainment is one of the co-creators of both the cassette and the CD and DVD. So they've been really big, kind of behind the scenes for a long time. Anyway, it's good news. Whatever you think about Gibson, and many people have a love-hate relationship with them, they did the right thing here by moving from Beverly Hills, which is where their showroom is right now, down to the Tower Records building on the Sunset Strip. They're not in it yet. They're supposedly doing $1 million worth of renovations, but sooner or later, they're going to be there, and it should be pretty cool. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@BobbyOInnerCircle.com, questions@BobbyOInnerCircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program, which is called 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. You can go to 101MixingTricks.com to learn more. My guest today is Bob Bullock, and he's worked with a variety of Nashville hitmakers like Kenny Chesney, Shania Twain, George Strait, Reba McEntire, Hank Williams Jr., and Jimmy Buffett, as well as Steely Dan, REO Speedwagon, Simon & Garfunkel, Chick Corea, and many, many more. I spoke with Bob from his studio in Nashville via Skype. So, Bob, thanks for being in my Inner Circle podcast today. It's good to talk to you again.
It's good to talk to you, too.
You started in L.A., right? You started your career in L.A. before you got to Nashville, right?
Right.
So, how is it that someone from L.A. gets to Nashville?
Okay. You know, at that time, I ended up moving to Nashville in 1984. So going back a few years before that, I was starting to do some work up in Northern California, working some at Fantasy Studios, working with various members of the Doobie Brothers on projects. And that's really where I thought I was going to relocate to, was Northern California. I got a call to consider joining the staff at Lion Share Studios that Kenny Rogers was purchasing, which was the old ABC recording studios where I had worked. So I had worked there in the past, and I had a lot of experience with it. Kenny Rogers recorded his song Lady there, and it was a huge success for him. That was probably about 1980, I guess. And so I got a call from somebody that I'd worked with before at ABC that was going to be part of the staff. And he asked me to consider, you know, doing that. So I joined Lion Share. It wasn't Lion Share at the time. That's what Kenny ended up calling it. And worked for Kenny Rogers for a couple years, actually. And during that time, I started meeting people from Nashville that would come to L.A. from Kenny's you know, past, you know, working in Nashville and everything, and that led to a few calls to come to Nashville and work on projects, and it became more and more. In 1983, I made 9 trips to Nashville from L.A., and I thought, well, I think I'll may try just. You know, try relocating there. I like Nashville a lot. So that's how it ended up.
Now, recording and mixing is different there, or at least it was different, right, from the way it is every place else.
Right.
But has that changed through the years? Is it more the same than different these days?
Recording and mixing?
Yeah.
For me, well, I mean, what I've really found is recording really hasn't changed for me, and maybe especially in Nashville, because the recording that I do here, it seems like my niche has definitely stayed with live band recording. I do very little MIDI and program stuff, so the recording process really hasn't changed at all. You know, all my tracking is all done in traditional tracking rooms with large format analog consoles. And in fact, the only change would be maybe from analog tape to Pro Tools. But in that environment, I'm using Pro Tools really as a tape machine.
Right.
The mixing process has changed a lot. So I'm doing most all of my mixing in my home studio, which is mostly in the box. I do have some hardware pieces, some reverb units and things that I like to use still, but more and more I'm doing, you know, plug-in stuff. So, yeah, for me, recording is kind of what hasn't changed much. And then once I shift into the mixing mode, that's where I'm using all the latest technology.
When you're recording in Nashville, are you recording the traditional large band with an 8 or 9 piece band complete with the fiddle player and the steel player and all at once?
Yep. Oh yeah. Yeah. That hasn't really changed much. Now, you know, as an engineer, you know, that's a little tougher way to go, because there's just so much that has to be, you know, taken care of at the same time. As a producer, I find that a great way to work, you know, because we're editing and doing everything really as we go, arranging as we go.
Yeah.
So the process is much more efficient doing that because, you know, even as a producer, if I cut a small group, which, as I said, for my engineering chops, it allows me to, you know, cater to just a few musicians. Once we go into overdub mode, the process slows down quite a lot.
Yeah.
So most of the time, that's how I'm tracking is with, you know, at least a 6-piece band.
Well, it sure makes it fun, that's for sure.
Well, it does. Yeah, it's exciting. You know, one thing that changed for me coming to Nashville is Nashville's always had kind of a more efficient way of working, and you know that it's a kind of a moving locomotive, you know, when you track here. When I came to Nashville from LA, I was used to, you know, we'd spend an entire day getting drum sounds.
Yeah.
And I certainly do think there's merit for spending time and getting sounds and things, so I don't think that the process should be all about just speed, but Nashville's kind of always had this very efficient way of cutting tracks, the Nashville number system, and, you know, musicians come in and they're just, you know, really ready, and it's amazing to me just how much we can do in a one day tracking date.
Well, that's a good question. Actually, how much can you do in a one day tracking day? I mean, I would always hear the stories about, you know, cutting 3 hits in a 3-hour session. But
yeah,
those days don't seem like they're still viable, though. Does that still happen?
Well, it can. I mean, you know, it varies. And again, it's not that I think it's all about speed either. I mean, I think there's a lot to be said for, you know, some classic records that took a long time to make because it's just, you know, it's chipping away at the sculpture, you know, and fine tuning. But a typical tracking date for me in Nashville would be at least, you know, one pretty completed song in a 3-hour session, and probably more so would be 2 songs in a 3-hour session, and that's pretty, you know, and that's with some overdubs and, you know, not necessarily final vocals unless the singer is, you know, is nailing performances. But you know, a demo session for songwriter demos would generally be anywhere from 4 to 6 songs in 3 hours.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. It's you definitely are flying, you know.
But again, that's fun. That's the best part about it, because I used to do commercials, jingles. Mm-hmm. And it was the same thing. In a 3-hour session, the first hour was tracking, the second hour is overdubs, and the third hour is mixing, and then you're out of there. And you had to abide by that schedule. And that was great, but boy, the pressure was really on.
Oh, yeah, it's a lot of pressure. It's like live shows, really.
Yeah. You
know? It's like you're really in a performance, you know, during that time. But then when it's over, it is over, you know, so that's good. So, yeah, it varies. Even for me, it depends on who I'm working with, what type of budget, you know, availability there is. You know, it's not that everything is slammed through. But, yeah, there is an energy to going in with a full band and, you know, saying, okay, we're going to really try to nail two master songs or, you know, maybe even three in this 3-hour session. And in fact, as a producer, generally what I do is when I book bands, because I know how, you know, efficient and, you know, great these musicians are, I'll usually have one song charted out, you know, extra, always, just in case we get ahead, you know.
Wow.
And sometimes we do. And I go, okay, gosh, I've still got an hour left and we've already done everything I was going to do. So let's cut this, you know, third song or something. So this
is with studio players that you're getting in. These are session guys that are coming in, right? And so they're walking in cold.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it still amazes me.
I mean, there's great players here and there's great players in New York and London and everything, but it's a different mentality.
Yeah, that's all. No, there's fantastic musicians, you know, in New York, LA. I mean, you know, we both know a lot of fantastic musicians. It's just, there's something about the Nashville mentality, like you said, that even, you know, musicians that come here from New York and LA and everything, they just kind of very quickly fall into this way of working, you know. It's not a bad thing. It's just it's kind of a real energized environment, and it still amazes me after all these years and probably thousands of recordings that we can have a rough demo of a song and basically a number chart, a lead sheet, you might say, and put everybody out there and everybody basically starts arranging parts and everything, and collectively in no time at all, you have something that really seems to work, and the musicians are able to perform it in one or two takes, you know?
That was my next question. How many takes usually do you do on something like this?
You know, today, because of working so much with Pro Tools, we can lay down a live track with a click and live vocal, and generally we'll probably do at least another pass or two using a playlist, you know, and a lot of times, even if the singer doesn't really want to sing it again, we'll just use the, you know, the click track and the original vocal, and unless there's really some arrangement ideas, and generally by the time we lay something down, there's not. We can just lay down another playlist, you know, track or two, and if someone, you know, feels, gee, my bass part was best on the first performance, I can, you know, use that. But most of the time, it's really not more than that.
Yeah. That's great. I mean, it's a great way to work. Jeez. Yeah. On the other hand, you've worked completely the opposite, working with Mutt Lange and working with Steely Dan. So, I mean, you're in a very unique position because you've seen both sides of it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know, it all works. It's all art. So, I mean, I have nothing, you know, but praise, you know, working, you know, with Mutt Lange. You know, I mean, he was just, you know, his records speak for him. I mean, but yeah, it's really a process, you know, of great attention to detail. The same thing in my younger days of being in the studio with Roger Nichols and Gary Katz and Donald Fagen, you know, and Walter Becker, and, you know, same thing, extreme, you know, attention to detail. But again, look at the end result, you know.
Now, when you're saying detail, is this in the performance? Is this in the arrangement? Is this in both? So how would you break that out? Was it in the sound?
It was everything. I mean, really, that was why, you know, records, I mean, that's why records with Mutt Lange can take so long to do, or the records that Steely Dan did, you know, and still Donald Fagen, you know, solo stuff. It's attention to detail in every way. Certainly the arrangements, the sounds. One of the things that it's always been, you know, wonderful for me as an engineer to get to work with those guys is that the sound is every bit as important as everything else.
Oh, cool. You
know? And of course, I love that, you know, so yeah. I don't mind at all that someone is willing to, well, let's try a lot of different recording techniques. Let's try a lot of different microphones. Let's try a lot of different mic preamps, you know, whatever it may be. Let's just, the sound is just is equally as important as the part I just wrote, you know.
How typical was it for you to, like, recut a track in those situations? So you get a track, it sounds pretty good, and you think, Gary or Donald or Mutt would say, well, you know, maybe we should do it again. And would that happen a lot?
Yeah, it did. In fact, you know, going back especially to the Steely Dan days and then even the early days that I worked with, you know, Mutt and everything, with analog tape, you know, we didn't have all the luxuries we have now, you know, playlists and all those things. So I certainly, you know, watched as on another day, you know, Steely Dan, you know, Donald and Walter would bring in a band and recut a track just because they wanted to change a hi-hat, you know, figure in the chorus or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And record an entire track with a, you know, band and, you know, studio musicians over that, because we didn't have the ability to, you know, make this kinds of cut and, you know, pace changes and everything we can now. And so I think even the last time I worked with Mutt Lange, it was, you know, with Pro Tools, and that kind of did evolve the process a little bit, because there was certainly more things that we could, you know, change within the same track.
Yeah.
But
the budgets must have been enormous.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, if you think back of the 70s, in fact, I had the, you know, good fortune, I guess you might say, to be one of the technical engineers on the Fleetwood Mac Rumors album. It was just for a couple of days. And Ken Collet actually wrote about it in his book about Rumors, you know, that they came to ABC Studios at the time because we had the equipment, and Jerry Faree, who was the chief tech, whoever contacted him said, oh yeah, we can put your overdubs back onto your original master safeties, because they literally had just worn out the tape. Tape was worn out. They lost a lot of fidelity on the original masters. And I think in Ken's book, this was 1976, I think he said that album cost about $1 million to make, you know?
Yeah.
So when you think of like today's dollars and everything, that's, you know, and that was kind of, you know, common. I mean, with a lot of these records where they were, you know, in budgets of $200,000, $300,000, $500,000, $1 million.
And, yeah.
But you know, these records not only are, you know, masterpieces of art, but look at the sales.
Well, it stood the test of time too. I mean, yeah. You know, even today they sound great. So it's not like, and not only that, it's not only our generation that still dig them. It's everybody else too.
Yeah, right.
So that's a kind of the cool thing. What are the budgets like now that you have to deal with?
Well, it's a lot different now, okay? I mean, even in Nashville, I mean, you know, budgets have always, for country music, always run less than you know, rock and pop and everything. I mean, Nashville's kind of always worked a little tighter budgets, but it's maybe all over the place, but probably safe to say, you know, most of the time, at least 50% of what they were maybe, you know, 5 years ago. So what the range of budgets would be, I mean, that's a difficult one to answer, really. For the major artists that are on the charts and everything, you know, they're going to certainly be the higher budgets. You know, a lot of indie projects are, you know, probably anywhere from 15,000 to 75,000 or something. You know, it's we're all having to work in a much more efficient way, and the technology has been on our side, as you know, on that. I mean, you know, we can do things more efficiently as far as home studios and all that are helping. The price to get into a home studio isn't what it was to get into a studio 20 years ago.
No kidding. Well, speaking of which, you're speaking to me in your brand new home studio,
right?
Your mixing studio, which is beautiful. And you're certainly getting great product out of it, which is so much easier to do these days. And you just said before we started to record that this is your third shot at it because you've moved. And that would have been impossible, you know, 10 years ago, 20, well, 15 years ago anyway. So that's very cool.
Yeah, well, and I enjoy that. I mean, you know, there's pros and cons to everything. The music business is music and art, it's a constant evolution, you know, I teach a little bit too, and I've pointed out that one of the things I think that's a prerequisite for, being in the arts, being in the music industry is you have to just really enjoy change, enjoy the challenge. You know, I've thought about this a lot myself. I mean, I never got into doing this because of, you know, money or security or anything. I got into it because I love it, you know, and I still love walking into a studio and working with everybody. And fortunately, you know, some things have worked out and I've been able to, you know, earn a living doing it and all, but that's never really been, you know, the reason for it. And so now I look at, you know, having this home studio and everything, I like, you know, going between working in a big tracking room, a large format console and everything. And then I also enjoy working in my home studio with the luxury of, I can work in multiple projects at the same time.
Yeah. You know? And multiple songs within the same project, which is beautiful.
Yeah, so it's all good. You know, it's just different. And, you know, I mean, gosh, thinking back at, you know, what it was like when, you know, I got the call as an engineer that we needed to go in and recall a mix, you know, because someone wanted to change one little thing.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, oh gosh, you know, that's at least half a day in the studio just to try to get back to where we were with, you know, Polaroid pictures of a Neve desk or something, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a good change and I enjoy what I'm doing.
I'm not nostalgic for those days at all. As a matter of fact, a year or so ago, I had an artist that really, really wanted to do analog tape.
Mm-hmm.
And I hated it. I hated every minute of it. And it's mostly because of the inconvenience factor.
Yeah.
You know, the big thing was the band's really hot. Time for do another take. Oh, wait, it's 4 minutes long. You have three minutes and 50 seconds of tape. So you got to wind it off, and then you get another reel, and you wind it on. And by that time, you've kind of lost the spark. You've lost the moment.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I'm with you. That's why I mean, I've found that I'm okay with the change, you know, with the evolution of it all, you know. Yeah. I mean, I do enjoy on a tracking thing. I like the excitement of all that, and I like working through an analog desk, and I like being able to do all these things simultaneously and get some, you know, good stuff on the front end. But you're right, you know, the tape, you know, the tape limitations. Oh my gosh, you know, I don't miss that. And that's why I said mixing. I really do prefer mixing the way that I'm mixing now. But, you know, because of I feel like the advantage of having time to get away from something and come back really far surpasses what I might think I missed of, you know, working on an analog desk, you know, because the thing I don't miss is, like you probably are thinking too, I don't miss the days of, well, we've got to get this last song because we only have the studio tonight, and tomorrow somebody else is in here for a month. So,
right. Well, just the fact that you're locked into a mix, you know, for your day and a half, you know, which was typical for the time, and that was a drag. It's like, okay, you kind of think you got it, but maybe not. But you got to move on because you only have X amount of days. So, yeah, I know. I'm not nostalgic for those days at all. Speaking of your studio, so last time we talked, you said that you had a lot of outboard gear, but you're getting rid of a lot of it because you found you were using it less. Is that still the case?
Yeah, it is. And it's, you know, as I'm finding things that I feel plugins are working for me. You know, the obvious advantage is all those things are part of my sessions. I typically mix in Nuendo. I also have Pro Tools 11. So in fact, I'm mixing. It's funny. I am, you know, here we're talking about this. I am simultaneously working on four different projects right now. Okay.
Yeah, love it.
They all have different deadlines, and so I'm just taking in my time with them. And when I get, you know, kind of bored with what I'm doing, where I think I'm getting fixated on something, I jump to another song or another project. One of them is a Pro Tools project, and three of them are Nuendo projects. Now, the reason one of them is a Pro Tools project is I started it by going to someone's studio that was Pro Tools and started the mixes there to get a foundation with the band and everything and you know, a comfort zone with them. And now I'm completing the last four songs here in my studio. And so I'm still keeping with Pro Tools because that's, you know, that was where we had started. As far as outboard gear, if I do use any of my outboard pieces, I create an audio track with them so it becomes part of the session. So I don't want to deal with tech notes and all that stuff.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
The days of having 90 pieces of outboard gear and tech notes, I don't miss that at all either, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say that, you know, for me, the technology is on our side. I mean, yeah, you know, I'm sure it sounds like you agree. I think that for a while, probably our computers were the weakest link, you know. The ability for someone to recreate the sound of a hardware piece with a plug-in. Now, with the power of the computers and the space we have with hard drives and everything, I just, for me, these plugins are getting better and better.
Let's come back to Nuendo for a second because I used Nuendo for a long time myself. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. I thought it was a great platform. I go back to Nuendo version 1, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, and that's where I started.
I had a change to Pro Tools. I got so sick of having to constantly import, export, and you know the problems that would happen in between that finally I just gave up and I went to Pro Tools.
Well, that's why I have Pro Tools, and I stay pretty current with it. So I'm running both systems. You know, now I'm not personally, I'm sticking to just those two. I don't want to, you know, spread myself out too thin with trying to, you know, stay up with, you know, too many DAWs here. But, and I, you know, have to say Pro Tools 11 is a really great system.
Yeah.
I really like it. You know, one of the things that works for me, and this is probably kind of an old school idea too, but I end up doing most of my recording with Pro Tools, you know, and because most of the studios that I cut tracks with, that's what they're running. It's more efficient for me to do that. And I like Pro Tools. So when I mix, I'm used to starting over just like I used to do with the analog days. Okay.
Yeah.
So I know a lot of people are using, you know, say Pro Tools because the session got started in Pro Tools and they're building plugins and all that. And that makes sense, you know, and that's kind of a new way of being able to work. Most of the projects I do, I just have someone send me audio files. I don't need a session, you know.
Yeah, sure.
And I start from scratch, kind of like the old school, like you're in this new studio, here's the desk, all the faders are down, you put the tape on and you start mixing.
Yeah, yeah.
So Nuendo works okay for me that way. And I like the system. I do like the system a lot, you know. It's just a more comfortable system for me to mix on. But
is it the sound or just the workflow of it?
Well, the workflow is better for me because among other things, I do prefer the mixer on Nuendo. I like the idea when I open it up, especially with Nuendo 6.5, there's just so much that's already built into the mixer. You know, you really don't have to build a template. I mean, it's just, there's so much that's already there. EQs, dynamics, all those things are already, you know, built into each channel. And I like that. Now, there was a time, and I'd, to be fair, I would have to do this again with, you know, Nuendo against Pro Tools 11, but there was a time when I had the opportunity to A-B against maybe Pro Tools 8 that I thought that Nuendo sounded much better.
Yeah, you know? Agreed.
And, you know, and so I don't really, you know, want to say that now because I know that there's been a lot of changes, you know, with both systems. So,
what are you using for an interface?
I'm using Lynx converters.
Oh, okay.
Yep. And I'm satisfied with those. I like the Lynx converters a lot.
Yeah.
I've had them for several years. I know there's been a lot of new things on the market, but at the time that I first, you know, started using the Lynx converters, I thought that they were, you know, like in the higher level of my choices that I had.
So. Yeah, sure. Sure. And you're using a Phantom Focus system from our mutual friend, Carl Tatz?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That's, I wouldn't leave home without it. that to me is, that's what's made mixing even, you know, more fun for me again, is having a consistent environment that has such accuracy of detail and everything, you know.
Yeah, agreed. When I heard it, I was very impressed.
Yeah, I absolutely, you know, love it. I love the reaction of, you know, when I have clients come in and listen to things in here, they're, you know, they all love it. It's, you know, the detail of that, you know, makes such a difference. It makes it fun to listen to music. You know, when I'm not working, I come in here and just listen to old recordings. And you know, I am still surprised at things that I hear in there that I never heard before, you know, the details. So,
well, again, went with their friend Ken Scott when we were listening, had that little listening session, and we played something back from the, I forget which Supertramp album it was.
Was it Crime of the Century?
Crime
maybe?
Of the Century, and I remember him turning and saying, "I'd never heard that edit before."
Yeah, right. Well, you know, since then he actually came to not the studio I'm in now, but he came to my previous studio. You know,
yeah.
Which I've only moved into this new one in July, and I loaded in some Supertramp stuff for him. You know, and we listened to it, and he pointed out some of those things too. You know, he said, "Gosh," he said, "you know, I never even got to hear it like that." You know, when we made those records, they were brilliant records.
Yeah.
And they still sound really good. But yeah, it's things like that. Like maybe there was an edit or something that went by, and now you can really pick it out.
Are you still teaching at two different colleges, right?
No, I'm teaching for Troy University in Troy, Alabama. I'm doing most of that via Skype and from my studio.
That's cool.
Yeah, and occasionally I'll go and I'll spend a couple days with the students there. But, yeah, most of it I'm doing long distance.
Wow. I do that occasionally, you know, for guest lectures and things like that. But I never even considered that would happen on a regular basis. You could do that. But I guess so. Why not?
Yeah, technology's on our side with all this now, you know, just like what you and I are doing right now. And what's exciting for me is being in a place like Nashville, Los Angeles, or New York. I mean, I was just out in L.A. I missed you, but I was at the AES show.
Yeah.
And, you know, being in these locations, you know, of course, makes you privy to a lot of workshops and demos and, you know, exhibits of things and all that. So that's one benefit for me. I can be here and go see an equipment demo at Vintage King or something on something new. And then do online classes without leaving my studio and, you know, show these students what's new with, things like Focusrite, you know, the Focusrite Red system. Yeah. In fact, I actually am going to demo that hopefully pretty soon because I'm really intrigued with that system.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, definitely.
So a lot of good reports about it.
Yeah, definitely. Last question for you. So what's the best piece of music business advice that you ever received from somebody or you've learned through the years?
Well, this is probably a roundabout way of answering that, because I don't know that I think there's any formula to success or failure or anything like that with the music business. But what I saw just from my, you know, young days being in the industry, and what's always mattered to me, and I think it's just kept me, you know, grounded, or, you know, whatever, is everybody that I've worked with, and everybody, you know, whether I was an assistant engineer, producer, whatever, everybody I'm working with, what we're doing is their dream, you know. Yeah. It's the most important thing to them, because it's their dream. You know, this is my song. This is a part of me. And I've always, the people that I've admired watching, that I've learned from, that was one of the one quality they brought to the sessions. And I've, you know, felt that I think that's probably the most important thing, you know, is just to always remember that. No matter who I'm working with, it wouldn't matter if it was, you know, Steely Dan or Shania Twain or somebody doing a demo. It's equally as important, you know.
Yeah.
So I've just really kind of always kept my eye on that ball, you know.
Yeah.
And I feel if I can, you know, do something, that I can bring something that makes them happy, that it makes them feel like, you know, I helped them achieve their vision. To me, that's the most important thing. So,
and you've done it well for a long time. Thanks so much, Bob, for doing this. It was a great chat, as always.
Well, anytime. Okay.
So. That's great. To find out more about Bob, go to his website at bobbullock.net. That's Bob Bullock, BULLOCK.net. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com, questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Also, don't forget about my new coaching program. It's called 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. You can go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino, who's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com, edmmr.com, and he helps put the show together. Thank you, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com, you'll also find a sign-up sheet for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski, and I'll see you next time.